To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA. Well, there's nothing quite like the holiday season. There's the family, the cooking, and of course, los regalos, the presents every child anxiously awaits.
It was a tradition in our family that each year, one of us was presented with an unusual gift, an enormous pair of the biggest, whitest polyester panties that you have ever seen.
On today's program, Christmas memories and traditions from Puerto Rico to the Texas-Mexico border.
Well, you know, the thing is, as a kid, I grew up with this idea of a Mexican Santa Claus. You know, when I went to a local grocery store, there was a man there dressed as Santa Claus, but he was wearing a big charro hat. And I asked my dad, well, who is this guy? And he said, well, that's Pancho. That's his Mexican cousin.
Also, Recuerdos de la Familia from StoryCorps Historias. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to discuss the news affecting the Latino community this week is Pilar Marrero, political writer for La Opinión, the nation's oldest Spanish-language daily newspaper. She's based in Los Angeles. Hola, Pilar.
Hola, Maria. It's great to be here.
So, Pilar, 2009 has been a pretty big year for Latinos. We helped vote in a new president. The first Latino Supreme Court justice was confirmed. There's a lot to celebrate in terms of the growing Latino political clout. But in terms of getting policy passed that directly affects the Latino community, the reality is that reality is something that we're still waiting for. One of the big policy issues, of course, is comprehensive immigration reform. And this week, Congressman Luis Gutierrez, a Democrat from Illinois, introduced legislation that would overhaul the nation's immigration laws and legalize undocumented workers. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of this new bill presented by Luis Gutierrez, let's talk for a little bit about the timing. Why introduce this bill now when the health care reform is still not clear? So why now?
Well, it is just the first bill. We are likely to see different bills come up. I think Gutierrez wants to pressure the political system and make sure that next year, when they start again in January, that this issue will be there. And the more they wait, the closer they are to the November midterm elections. So that's also a danger, that if you let things wait too long, because the process is long, as you can see with healthcare. So he's just trying to be the first and to set the example in a way and say, look, you know, we need to address this. You promised it, and Latinos are waiting for it.
So what exactly does the bill call for? And if there's a legalization or a so-called amnesty, how does that, what does it look like?
It's 800 pages, so I haven't read them all. But basically, in terms of the legalization, it calls for undocumented immigrants who arrived here before December 15, meaning, you know, a few days ago, to be legalized, of course, with a number of conditions. It calls for restructuring of how visas are issued, deep reforms to the detention system. It calls for greater independence for immigration judges so they can have more leeway in making some of these decisions on deportations and family separation. It also calls for a national strategy in border security. I mean, it calls for a commission to evaluate the country's labor needs. I mean, it calls for a lot of things that have been talked about. And it basically is throwing everything out there for discussion. And, of course, he knows he's not going to get everything, but he thinks that he should throw, you know, everything that we want is out there, and then we'll see what we can get. We know we have to negotiate. I guess that's what he's thinking.
In the short term, there was some good news for the family of Luis Ramirez. He's the young man who was killed in July of 2008. He was an undocumented Mexican immigrant living in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania. So 6 months ago, two teens were acquitted of the murder of Luis Ramirez, along with charges of ethnic intimidation. But this week, a total of five people were indicted on charges relating to this same case, including three police officers. So what's the backstory here, Pilar, and what does it mean that there will be a new trial for in the murder of Luis Ramirez?
Well, these are federal charges. The Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice went in and took a look at this situation and came up with enough evidence to get a federal grand jury to indict. It's very interesting because they issued three indictments one of them is against the two young football players from Shenandoah who allegedly killed Luis Eduardo Ramirez back in July of last year. The other indictment, the second indictment, charges the chief of police of Shenandoah and two other police officers with obstructing justice and several charges in relation to obstruct justice in this case. And the third indictment includes the police chief and his second-in-command for other corruption, not directly related to the Ramirez case, but shows that, you know, there were more shenanigans going on in this little town than just the Luis Ramirez case. There was extortion and there were other things. So I think that the good news is that the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice is working again after not working for 8 years of the Bush administration. And they're now investigating Sheriff Arpaio in Arizona. So we'll see what happens.
Pilar Marrero, thank you so much for joining us. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays to you.
Pilar Marrero is the political writer for La Opinión, the nation's oldest Spanish-language daily newspaper based in Los Angeles. You're listening to a special holiday edition of Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
It was a tradition in our family that each year, one of us was presented with an unusual gift, an enormous pair of the biggest, whitest, stretchiest polyester panties that you have ever seen.
In 1999, the book Last Christmas, Favorite Latino Authors Share Their Holiday Memories, was released by Vintage. Back then, we asked some of the authors to read their stories for us, and one in particular, we have to admit, stood out from the rest. It's told by New Mexico writer and activist Denise Chavez. Her story is simply titled, Big Calzones.
Signs, Queen Ultra Mega 4X Clownish Enormous Drawers. Just to look at them made you laugh out loud. Mother bought them at Aronson Brothers Clothing Store on Main Street, in our little hometown of Las Cruces, Nuevo Mexico. Each year, she wrapped this huge pair of breeches in the loveliest paper, tied with an elaborate bow, and gave them to some unsuspecting but delighted soul in our immediate family. The package was opened to squeals of laughter. You never knew when it would be your turn to receive the panties. My mother's sense of humor was legendary, and sometimes diabolical. Despite her propriety as a teacher and single mother, she had a great sense of the ridiculous and liked to take photographs of people in disarray. She often ambushed my sister or me in the bathroom, a towel draped loosely around a naked body seated on the toilet, hair in curlers, reading the National Enquirer. She kept an album of crazy photographs that I still treasure today. That first year, I was the one who first received the big calzones. As I opened the beautifully wrapped gift, I had no idea why there was a special twinkle in my mother's eye. We all had a huge laugh as we passed around the giant panties and tried them on. After all was said and done, our little street, La Colonia, was asleep but for the one house with its trinity of windows, a blue or pink or white or silver flock tree in the corner of the living room, lights woven through the branches covered in angel hair, an incredible pile of presents underneath so high it scattered halfway across the room. Contented, we dragged ourselves to bed, our family at peace. Our disappointments, petty disagreements, and arguments tabled for another day. My sister and I were tucked in, our father safe at home at last for a little while. Mother, her long black hair flowing down her back, her full bosom heaving happily, turned off all but the Christmas tree lights. She stood in the doorway to her room, her face moist, a little dot of color on each cheek. Her door was left open a crack and would stay that way as she waited for that one special late-night visitor. The big calzones were draped over the couch like a banner. The night was beautiful, silent, still. There was no jarring whistle from the train at the end of the block. In the clear and dark morning, that blessed early morning, the calm was only broken by the sound of muffled voices, rustling bodies, hope.
Author Denise Chavez is the founding artistic director of the Border Book Festival based in Las Cruces, New Mexico. While Christmas is the big holiday that gets most of the attention here for many people who live in the Caribbean, January 6th is bigger than Santa Claus. A few years back, writer Joe Pacheco sent us his memory of a 1930s holiday trip to the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, where he first learned about Three Kings Day, or El Día de los Reyes Magos.
In 1934, I went to visit the island of Vieques with my mother. No hable inglés en Vieques. Do not speak English in Vieques. I still remember my mother's words a few days before Christmas and after we had just completed a five-day steamship voyage to Puerto Rico and the long drive in a público to Fajardo, where we were waiting for la lancha to brave the choppy straits for 2 hours and land us on my mother's home island, Vieques, an island off the eastern shore of Puerto Rico in the West Indies. And I still remember that when half the island came to greet my mother and see the first Americano born in the family and hear him speak English and kept demanding, habla inglés, that I held out for as long as I could. But the bribes of bananas, oranges, sugarcane, and pennies were too great for 4-year-old me to resist. And I succumbed by reciting the first stanza of the Star-Spangled Banner, and even though I was not too sure of the meaning and pronunciation of many of the words, a shower of applause and pennies rewarded my first adventure into performance poetry. A few days later, I wowed the crowd even more when I remembered it was Christmas and added to my repertoire, Santa Claus is Coming to Town. But when I asked, ¿Cuándo viene Santa Claus? I was given the bad news. Vieques was one town Santa didn't go to. Everyone watched my reaction in a careful silence until my devastation was relieved by my uncle's revelation that there were tres reyes who delivered presents not on Christmas Day, but on January 6th, because the camels on which they traveled were much slower than reindeer. They would be tired and hungry, and if I left some straw for them in a shoebox, the next morning I might find presents. Three Santas, three times more presents, I remember thinking in English. And they don't even have a list of who's naughty and nice.
Joe Pacheco is the former superintendent of the New York City school system. He's now retired and lives on Sanibel Island in Florida. Santa Claus. You know him well, right? Well, maybe not as well as you think you did. For example, did you know that Santa Claus has a Mexican cousin who speaks both Spanish and English, who wears a charro hat, that big Mexican sombrero, and helps Santa on Christmas Eve to deliver all the toys, the juguetes? Well, his name is Charro Claus. That's the name of a new children's book by San Antonio author and illustrator Javier Garza. And Javier joins me today from the studios of station KSTX in San Antonio. Bienvenido, Javier.
I'm glad to be here. It's a real honor and a real pleasure to be here.
You've got this great book that you wrote and drew. It's really kind of 1960s, 70s pop art comic bookish. But tell our listeners the story quickly behind Charro Claus.
Well, you know, the thing is, as a kid, I grew up with this idea of a Mexican Santa Claus. You know, when I went to a local grocery store, there was a man there dressed as Santa Claus, but he was wearing a big charro hat. And I asked my dad, well, who is this guy? And he says, well, that's Pancho. That's his Mexican cousin. And the idea stayed with me. And later on, I wanted to write a story about the Mexican Santa Claus. And so it features Uncle Pancho and his nephew Vincent. And Santa Claus is trying to deliver presents to all the kids that live on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. But with immigration being the big mess that it is, he's having a lot of problems going back and forth, back and forth. So he asks his cousin Pancho to help him. And Vincent, you know, watches as his uncle is transformed into Charro Claus, and he wants to tag along. So he sneaks on the wagon that is being pulled by the magical flying burros that all wear lucha libre masks. And eventually they go to the first house, and they get caught by a little girl who asks the question, who are you? You're not Santa Claus. And Uncle Pancho has to explain, it's true. I am not Santa Claus, but I am his Mexican cousin. And then they go on to deliver presents to all the kids that live on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. And in the end, Vincent is transformed into the Texas Kid.
Is this for you like a real border phenomenon? Or when you think about it, it's like, no, a lot of kids around the United States of America can identify with this story.
Well, I think as, you know, as the Hispanic population gets bigger and bigger, you know, there's the concept of a Mexican Santa Claus has been getting more and more, you know, played around. I mean, even, you know, Lalo Guerrero had that famous song, Pancho Claus. And, you know, and which I grew up with as a kid, which, of course, you know, was part of the catalyst for this story. And, you know, growing up, I remember my first memories of Santa Claus are watching him in the Rio Grande City parade. And he, of course, would ride on a wagon dressed in a charro hat. And this whole concept started because somewhere, somehow, some person that was dressed in a Santa Claus outfit thought it would be cool to put on a charro hat so as to fit in with the community. And this person gave birth to this phenomenon. I mean, we even in Houston, Richard Reyes has a play called Pancho Claus, but his Pancho Claus is a suit-wearing Santa Claus that goes around in a flying lowrider delivering presents to the kids of the barrio.
Oh, that sounds interesting, too.
So, you know, there's this whole concept that has been around. And so when I decided that what had never been done was an origin story, you know, I love the Lalo Guerrero song. But it was basically, it's a very Mexicanized version of The Night Before Christmas. But I could, you know, I couldn't find an origin story. And you said, you know what, I'm going to make one. And I'm going to call it Charro Claus and the Texas Kid. And Texas Kid with a J, of course.
So let me ask you a question about bilingual or Charro Claus. What would he say? Would he say ho, ho, ho? Or what does Charro Claus say?
Charro Claus, he just says Feliz Navidad, you know, every day, to everybody. And I guess he would go ha 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 or ho ho ho. I guess he would go back and forth between the two. But the idea behind him is that yes, he is Santa Claus' cousin, but he's his own man, because there's a scene in the story where he asks Santa Claus, when he asks him to help, he says, am I going to have to wear a red and white suit like you? I mean, no offense, primo, I love you, but I've always thought you look very silly. And he says, no, you can be your own man. Do you still have that old charro outfit you used to wear back in your singing days? And that in turn leads to him becoming Charro Claus.
Javier, thank you so much for this book. It's really, really wonderful. Good luck.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Muchas gracias.
Javier Garza is an author and illustrator living in San Antonio, Texas. His new book, Charro Claus and the Texas Kid, is published by Cinco Puntos Press. In a minute, Cuentos del Pasado. Historias from StoryCorps. That's coming up. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Time now for StoryCorps Historias. Today we'll hear about two women who, although they've passed on, have left an enduring mark on their families. First, we hear from Richard Anthony Torres when he was interviewed by his daughter, Kathy Namba. He told her about his mother and the lessons she taught him.
I could see her patience, that she just took everything as it came. And as a young man, I was very anxious and running around and everything. But just, as I got older, I learned from her. And that's why I can pass it on to you guys.
She had to have been really patient because there were so many kids.
Five boys, five girls. It was a lot of fun, but it was a madhouse. This was towards the end of the Depression. She used to tell me a lot of times, she'd say, oh, boy, I said, my mother really had it hard. And I used to think, your mother, what about you? But she never complained. And I was the eldest of the males in Hispanic culture that puts you as a head. So I left school at an early age, and I got a job. And all through my single life, whatever I earned, I gave my mother half of it. So that helped a lot. In the later years, I would go at least every 3 months to be with her and spend some time with her. And
whatever time of day you would walk in, she'd be sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee.
Well, you know, I have a picture of her on the table there. So every morning, I have coffee with Ma, and I feel her presence still. I always tell you girls, the reason I can love you so much or my grandchildren is because I was so loved.
Yeah.
I still feel it.
We feel it, too.
Thank you.
That was Richard Torres with his daughter, Kathy Namba, in Taos, New Mexico. Our next story also comes from Taos. The Mascareñas family has been farming for five generations. Lucille Mascareñas married into the family in the 1960s, and she recently told her son, Victor, what happened when she moved from the city to her husband's family farm.
Your dad was raised with his grandparents. His grandmother called him mi alma, which was like her soul, her sustenance, everything that she was, she poured into this little child. And she only spoke Spanish. And I understood Spanish, but I didn't speak it. I remember one of the first experiences that I had alone with her. Your dad told me, well, you're going to help her out in the garden today. And I thought, well, how fabulous. So I started hoeing away. Well, I was uprooting plants. And pretty soon, all I heard was camota. And I kind of got the connotation of that. And it wasn't real happy. And I stopped in my tracks. And she took the hoe away from me. And when your dad got home, she was telling him, esa camota something or other, y americana, americana, she would say. And she would hit the cupboard. She's been acting like that all day, I told him. And she's just very mean. And I apologize, but she simply refuses to accept my apology. And I left the room.
You know, I think she looked at you and felt that you really need to be straightened up.
You needed to know something, definitely, which I didn't. I knew the top 10 on the radio and I could do my nails, but I didn't even know how to cook. I used to make tortillas and I'd cut them out with a plate so they would be perfect. Now, in retrospect, even as harsh as she was with me, I appreciate her very, very much. I remember one day she told me, vamos a hacer una quilta. To make a quilt. And she had three small flour sacks. And she told me that we were going to begin with those. And as we were doing it, she'd tell me these stories about when she was first married and her children and even bearing children. And then by the end of the day, we had our quilt done. And then she like reached over and she tapped me like that on my knee. And I thought she accepted me. It was like an acceptance almost. And I remember looking at her hands, and they were gnarled, and they were old, and they were wrinkled. And I took her hand in my hand, and I could feel calluses. And I turned them over, and I rubbed them. And I remember thinking that this was a hand of dignity, that the things that she created, not just in her hard labor, but in that quilt and her children, it said it all. And I just thought to myself, what a wonderful lady she is. I had learned. And she had taught me.
Lucille Mascareñas with her son Victor at StoryCorps in Taos, New Mexico. All StoryCorps Historias interviews are archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. To learn more about this project, go to our website at latinousa.org. And now, commentator Michelle Cerros.
In 2002, it was with great reluctance that I agreed to take a position as a staff writer for a new Hollywood television sitcom. Great reluctance because I had just become the new owner of a pre-owned, gently used IBM ThinkPad TransNote laptop, with which I had planned to devote hours and hours of writing that novelesque, slightly memoirish, creative nonfiction novella, the one I'd been putting off for years. However, in addition to the many perks the job offered, a steady paycheck, my own office, the opportunity to contribute to a wider representation of Latino life to a larger audience, I learned that after working a mere 20 weeks on the George Lopez show, that I would be bestowed with the highly coveted benefits of full coverage health insurance. My new co-workers for the new Latino-themed show were mostly men, non-Latino. Not surprising, as I have often heard such a demographic was typical in the writing rooms of Hollywood, a place where I learned the work environment to be very much like a grade school classroom, in the sense that there was always that one attention-seeking kid vying for the sole attention of the one in charge, not the teacher, but the Hollywood executive producer. And one way to get attention? With jokes. Lots of jokes. Jokes centering on flatulence, fat women, and in this particular TV show's case, Mexicans. There were a lot of Mexican jokes. The type that I endured as a young Mexican-American girl growing up in Southern California, which often came across as painfully offensive, stereotypically demeaning. And just as a young girl in grade school, upon hearing such jokes, my stomach began to hurt a lot. Unfortunately, I learned that there was no such thing as speaking up or speaking out against such jokes. But just as my agent promised, I got my health insurance. Writers Guild of America certified health insurance card, complete with my individual policy number and those three magic words, emergency admission approval. It was all too good to be true. And while I am proud to have been on a Latino-themed show that could and did succeed, it was easy enough for me not to renew my option the following season of the George Lopez show. In spite of a Hollywood healthcare policy that offered generous deductibles for everything from post-rehab psychiatric therapy to surgical body enhancements, the wisest choice for me was to charge up my pre-owned, gently used IBM ThinkPad and focus on a career path that my health could most definitely afford.
Michelle Cerros is a writer based in New York. Her most recent book is Scandalosa, a honey blonde chica novel, published by Simon & Schuster. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. We had help this week from Nadia Raymond and Michael Garofalo of StoryCorps. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
It's Latino USA. Every holiday season, the landscape of America changes. Lights are strung up from trees and rooftops. Greeting cards are tacked up by the fireplace, if you've got one. And every year, Christmas songs fill the air. Jingle bells, Silent Night, and of course, Feliz Navidad.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad.
With 6 Grammy Awards and more than 45 gold and platinum records, José Feliciano's contribution to American music is so much more than just Feliz Navidad.
As a kid, I was thinking about the things that all kids think about. I want to be a real rock and roll daddy cool, you know?
Coming up, join me for an intimate conversation with the legendary José Feliciano. I'm María Hinojosa. For the news this week, a focus on arts and culture and a little country named Latinia. So you say you've never heard of Latinia? Well, consider this story. A young man's mother is from Guatemala. His father is Ethiopian. He was born here and doesn't always know where he fits in. Poet and performance artist Quique Aviles is intrigued with the voices of these hybrid citizens. And recently, he invented a country for them in a new one-man show called Latinia. Producer AC Valdez sat down with Quique Aviles in Washington, D.C. and sent us this report.
Latinia started as a joke, says Quique Aviles, a way to deal with the constant question in every immigrant's life.
People ask me where I'm from. So I got kind of tired of explaining that I'm a Salvadorian, you know, because one of the things that people expect, especially Latinos, is that if you don't talk like a Salvadorian peasant, people say, oh, my God, I can't believe you are from El Salvador. You know, I thought you were Puerto Rican. I thought you were Mexican. So I got kind of sick of that. So I started saying, you know, I'm from Latinia. And people would give me these weird looks and like, Latinia, where is that? I would say, well, I'm a Latino and therefore I'm from the land of Latinia.
Quique Aviles says he meets these mixed kids everywhere and is amazed at the unlikely combinations, Mexican-Mongolian Americans and Ethiopian-Salvadoran Americans. In his show, The Children of Latinia, he digs deeply into the life of one young man who is half Ethiopian and half Guatemalan. Quique says as he tried to portray him, he searched for the right name, a strong one, and came up with Tonatiuh Robles Biru.
Tonatiuh is a god of Mexican mythology. I think he's an Aztec god. But I thought it was fitting because this kid is kind of looking for his identity, and I thought that it would be a good thing to give him an indigenous name. So his mother is from Guatemala, and she is a very socially conscious person.
That made me think of the piece where he's talking about his mother being a troublemaker in the unions and then his dad being this very silent cab driver type. Could you read a little bit of that? Do you have that
sure.
with you?
It says, my father is gentle, quiet, almost subservient. He's an educated man, came here with a degree in economics, but couldn't get a job in his field. So like a lot of African immigrants, he's a cab driver. The way I see it, he spends his days taking other people's dreams around the city to their destination, but his own never go nowhere. Yeah, he's all about playing by the rules. Never speak against America, the country that lets you in. My mom is the complete opposite. She's a nurse. Back home in Guatemala, she was a union leader for hospital workers. So basically, she's a big mouth. Fight the man, fight the system. Ah, to hell with the government. Viva la mujer. So here I am, right in the middle, with a mother that won't shut up about Yankee imperialism, inequality, and injustice, and a father that barely talks. My mom teaching me to be a fighter, to never shut up. My father trying to teach me to be silent.
Tonatiuh, throughout the play, tries to find the balance between speaking and silence. Sometimes this means exercising his politics. Here, Aviles captures Tonatiuh, describing marching to support immigrant rights.
For a long time, all this stuff about justice was just a bunch of words. I didn't really know what it all meant. But all that changed for me March 2006. Las marchas. In cities all across the country, people took to the streets and marched for immigrant rights. I marched right here in D.C. We started out at Malcolm X Park and went down all the way to the mall. Man, that's what made it all real for me. Marching and shouting with thousands of people. No human being is illegal. No human being is illegal. Being a part of this mass of people, I got it. After that march, I began to ask myself questions. You know, what does it mean that I'm from here and my mom's from Guatemala and my dad's from Ethiopia? Being out there with people that are being rejected by American society, I discovered the power of my voice as an American, just like my mom's been trying to teach me all these years. And you know what the best part of the whole thing was? Marching hand in hand with Jocelyn and the rest of the crew, Señor Distortion, La Becky, and Elmo, El Mojado, yelling together, "What do we want? Justice. When do we want it? Now. What do we want? Legalization. When do we want it? Now." Man, it was a beautiful moment, even romantic. I think this was the first time that Jocelyn and I looked into each other's eyes and felt the same thing right here in our heart without having to say anything.
Performer Kike Aviles from his new work, The Children of Latinia. For Latino USA, I'm A.C. Valdez.
It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On today's program, we bring you a special broadcast from our archives. In the year 2005, I sat down with the legendary singer José Feliciano to talk about his life and music.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad.
This year, José Feliciano celebrated 50 years in show business. Born blind in Puerto Rico and raised in New York's Spanish Harlem, he's best known for the Christmas classic Feliz Navidad. José's earliest success didn't come in this country, but in Argentina, where his recordings of classic boleros made him a superstar.
Usted es la culpable de todas mis angustias. Y todos mis quebrantos. Usted llenó mi vida de amargas inquietudes y amargos desencantos.
A string of hits in the late 1960s made him a heartthrob and a household name in the United States, but then a controversy over his performance of the national anthem at the 1968 World Series almost destroyed his career. He's recorded more than 45 gold and platinum albums and has won 6 Grammy Awards. Today, he's still a gifted artist with a passion for social justice, and he's added fatherhood to his resume. Feliciano, now in his 60s, shows no signs of slowing down. We're very pleased to bring you now this special holiday edition of Latino USA. From the studios of WNYC Public Radio Station in New York, with the one and only José Feliciano.
It's not often that I get serenaded even before I start asking questions. So, you know, Jose, the interesting thing is that I remember when I was a little Mexican girl growing up on the south side of Chicago, and I heard Feliz Navidad for the very first time, and I felt like my two worlds had come together in song. And here's the crazy thing, Jose, that now my little girl, who's 7 years old, runs around the house singing Feliz Navidad. And it's like the circle is complete. I'm sure that thousands of people have told you similar stories.
When I wrote Feliz Navidad, I was sitting with my record producer, Rick Gerard, a very dear friend. And Rick said to me, as we were sitting in my house in July, "Why don't you write a Christmas song?" So I thought about it. And I started going, Feliz Navidad, Feliz Navidad, Feliz Navidad, Prospero año y felicidad. And so Rick was really thrilled, and I was thrilled. And all of a sudden, I started thinking, but wait a minute. I should write it in such a way that the radio stations will have no excuse not to play it. In other words, the Spanish stations will play it, but the big American top 40 stations will play it as well. So I put in, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas.
I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. And later on, I realized that I was teaching the Spanish people to speak English, and I was teaching the Americans how to sing Spanish. And if I've opened, or if I've brought our culture, because, you know, I'm Puerto Rican and you're Mexican, but you're still Latino, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if I've brought our culture to people, then I'm really happy, because I feel that in order for the Spanish people to be strong, we all have to unite.
But you were growing up in East Harlem, Spanish Harlem, New York City, after you moved here from Puerto Rico. Tell me, as a child, were you processing this all? Were you saying we're Latinos and we have to unite and we have to keep Spanish and English? I mean,
No, as a kid, I was thinking about the things that all kids think about. I want to be a real rock and roll daddy cool, you know?
All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be safe and warm if I was any late. Oh, California dreaming on such a winter's day.
So, but I want you to take me back
sure.
to growing up Puerto Rican in New York City. I wrote down in my notes, I wrote from jíbaro to hippie, because of course you ended up going to Folk City and playing folk music. But in order to do that, you left your parents behind and took off to be, I don't know.
To be me. Well, at 17, I did. I went down to Greenwich Village. I met people like Bob Dylan, who's still my friend today. I met Paul Simon, whom I love. I met so many wonderful people. I think, you know, I never in my wildest dreams, Maria, thought that I would be a famous artist. The reason I play this instrument is because I love it. It's part of me. It's my way of doing paintings, musical paintings, whether it be singing or instrumentally, you know. The guitar creates a mood. It's such a beautiful instrument. You know, like you can make it do things like, and it creates a mood, you know. When you're sad, it comes out. But when you're happy, you know, you got. You know, so you have those kind of things, and it lets you express these things.
But at that time, when you're meeting the Bob Dylans of the world and the Paul Simons of the world, and you're at your youthful prime, and I didn't know because I was too young in the late 1960s. I'm giving away my age, but I didn't realize that you were such a teen idol and that riots would break out whenever you'd walk out on the street.
It's true. When I started recording the Boleros back in 1966, I couldn't believe what happened. It scared me, really. It was the first time as a blind person I had to learn to run into a limousine.
Wow.
It was as if I were one of the Beatles, you know, or Elvis Presley. I was a little embarrassed by it because, I don't know, I didn't expect something like that from me. I mean, you know, I wasn't Frank Sinatra, I wasn't Elvis Presley.
So when did it take off for you in the United States? What was the hit that made it for you here?
It was this one, Maria. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time for hesitation's through. There's no time to wallow in the mire. Darling, we could only lose, and our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on
fire.
I'm so glad you played that because, of course, I wanted to ask you about that song, but I was like, pero como le vas a preguntar a José Feliciano about Light My Fire when everybody asks him about that song, and yet the way you do it, José, it's just incomparable. You know, you became more than just a folk singer. You became somebody who then started taking all kinds of challenges. I mean, let's talk about what happened with the national anthem. You created a controversy sin querer, without really wanting to.
I did. I didn't know that it would be the controversy that it was. As a matter of fact, veterans started throwing shoes at their television during the game when I came on. There was a movement to deport me, which I thought that was hilarious. How could they deport me from my own country?
Tell me the story of how that happened.
A very dear friend who was the Tiger announcer, Ernie Harwell, invited me to sing the national anthem. I remember at the time, too, in 1968. I'll give you just a little flavor for it.
Please.
But I went... Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? And I sang it, you know, in a different way rather than the conventional way, because I myself got tired of watching the ball game and hearing people just singing the anthem and the crowd, like when they got near the end, really clapping, like, let's get going here, you know. So I decided to do it in a soulful way, and I caused a controversy that I didn't want to cause. My records were stopped for,
oh my God,
for quite a while. Actually, it wasn't until I wrote the music for Chico and the Man that I finally started to dig my way out of it. But it was tough.
You have said that music is the best healer of all wounds. For me, just sitting here being serenaded by the José Feliciano, of course, whatever preocupaciones, worries, concerns, rush, anxiety I had before coming here, they're lifted. But for you, tell me why you think so strongly that music is such a healer.
When I was younger, I was a very complex individual. I didn't accept being blind so easily because I couldn't go and play with the kids, and I felt inferior at the time. But yet, when I picked up this piece of wood in my hands and I played it, it got rid of those complexes and made me realize that I wasn't inferior. I wasn't superior necessarily, but that at least I wasn't inferior, that I had something that I could give and something I could share with people.
Chico, don't be discouraged. The man, he ain't so hard to understand. Chico, if you try now, I know that you can lend a helping hand, because it's good in everyone and a new day has begun. You can see the morning sun if you try.
We'll be back in a minute for more of my conversation with the legendary José Feliciano. No se vayan. Stay with us.
Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. We're visiting with musical legend José Feliciano. Now, José, you have, I'm not sure if I want to call it a political sense about you. I mean, it seems to me that there's just much more of a human rights sense about your whole life. And you recently wrote another song that, fast forward from 1968, the Vietnam War, uh-huh. You have recently written a song about no violence and essentially saying this war needs to stop.
Definitely. By the same token, though, I do support my troops because it's not their fault that they were sent out there. So I want to thank them for fighting for the way of life that I have now. But I wrote Killing's Not the Answer. I'll give you a little taste of it. It goes, September morn, we'll live in infamy. It opened up my eyes for me. Democracy's a high ideal. Without peace, it can't be real. We must stop selling weapons of war. Let's all work hard so we won't need them anymore. I know it's easier said than done. So people, now the time has come. Killing's not the answer. No matter what you say, killing's not the answer. It isn't God's way. We all must get together and try to help mankind. We must stop the fighting, yeah. 'Cause fighting makes us blind.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And a lot of it came from your experience also of September 11th.
It moved me. The experience moved me that we could be attacked in such a way and that something like this could happen. And worst of all the people's lives that were changed that day, and those who lost family and brothers and sisters and friends, those things moved me very much. And that's why I went into my studio, and within a few days I had written the song.
So for you, even though you're celebrating 50 years of being on stage and performing, for you the possibility of finding inspiration, of feeling like you still want to play, still want to create, it's as alive as ever before?
Oh, it is. I think more so, because in my younger days, I wasn't as good at putting words together as I've become now. I think now I've learned more about poetry, you know. I think whenever a teacher would want me to write a poem, I always started out there. Once was a man from Nantucket. And that's as far as I'll go.
So part of what's fascinating about this new album, which is called Six String Lady, is that it's all instrumental, and it appears that, you know, it was your fans really that were asking you via your website. Is that true?
Yes, it is, Maria. People would say, why don't you cut an instrumental album on guitar? And I would say, yeah, I want to do it, you know, someday. But I never got around to it until a few years ago when I got my studio. On some of the instrumentals, I play more than one instrument, Maria. I play guitar, I play percussion, I play, you know, congas, bongoses, maracas, bajo. So I use those kind of talents to keep the budget down. Thank you.
But you decided then, in fact, to open this CD, Six String Lady, with music for Andres Segovia, who,
well, definitely.
Was, who was a huge influence in your life.
He was. Segovia brought respectability to the guitar. Before Andres Segovia, the guitar was considered a gypsy's instrument that had no value. I mean, even Juilliard didn't have a guitar curriculum. They have one now, but they, when I wanted to, let's say, go to music and art high school, they wouldn't accept me because guitar wasn't considered a real respectable instrument. But along came Segovia and showed people that you could do wonderful things classically with the guitars.
What's going on for you now, Jose? Where are you in your life at this point? You're celebrating 50 years of being a performer. You have this new CD, but inside, there's obviously some tumult about what you see going on around you. But what's going on for you?
Well, I think I'm in the prime of my life musically. As a person, I've gained a lot because I have three children. So I have a lot to be happy about, and I am. And more than happy, I know I'm grateful, and I want to continue playing the guitar, hopefully. I hope that God gives me enough health so I can be around for a little longer.
Thank you so much, Jose Feliciano.
María, muchas gracias por todo, por ser mi amiga, y espero que las cosas que tú deseas, pues, se te cumplan.
Igualmente, right back at you, Jose. You look fabulous.
Thank you, darling. Thank you very much. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad para María en este año. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. Con pozole. Wish you a Merry Christmas. Want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. Darling of my heart.
Latino USA is produced by Alex Avila, Adam Seitanidis, Walter Morgan, and Angela Maldonado. The executive producer is Sean Collins. Our special thanks to Neil Golub and the staff of WNYC in New York, and Mario Garcia and M Studios in Santo Domingo. Our listener comment line is 1-800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
I say to the producer, I'm going to do it my way or no way at all. And they said, well, if you don't do Gucci Gucci, you're going to get broke. And I said, well, if I don't sell CD, I always can be an English teacher.
Do you recognize that voice? It's the incomparable singer, guitarist, and quintessential performer, Charo.
I pass Broadway to do The Life of Carmen Miranda, but I make my mind, my son is going to be a kid, regular, don't belong in your business, and he's not going to write a book called Gucci Gucci Dearest.
On today's program, an intimate conversation with Charo. She describes herself as a show business pioneer, and her story may surprise you.
coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us.
For the news this week, a focus on arts and culture, and a new book by author Chesa Boudin. Chesa has quite a history: prep school in Chicago, Yale, and then a year as a Rhodes Scholar. That, and yes, there's the influence of four sets of parents, all political militants, all members of the Weather Underground. Chesa Boudin's biological parents were imprisoned for their role in the Brinks robbery in 1981. After that, family friends Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn took him in and raised him. Chesa Boudin feels, though, that his best lessons were learned by traveling in South America. And that's what he writes about in his book, Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. And Chesa Boudin joins us now on Latino USA. Welcome to our program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So, I don't know. I already have a new title for your book. Do you want to hear it?
I do.
A Gringo's Guide to Backpacking Real-Life Politics, La Izquierda and Growing Up.
That sounds good. I think we should suggest it to the publisher for the second printing.
You know, for those of us who spend any time backpacking in Latin America in an attempt to understand ourselves and our place in the continent, it's just a great book of just, you know, putting you in the moment. You take off for Latin America and you decided there was something that you needed to find in life. Why was it that it was pointing you south?
Well, I think there were a number of factors. One of them was simply that I had been studying Spanish as a student in high school and in middle school, and I wanted to be able to actually learn to communicate in Spanish. But there were a whole range of other factors. I mean, certainly the fact that my cousins are half Puerto Rican, the fact that both of my parents, from the time I was a baby, were incarcerated with a large number of Latinos, and you know, many of whom I had built a relationship with while visiting my parents in their prisons. All of those things encouraged me to think about Latin America.
One of the things that I like so much about the book is that you're just very honest. It's kind of like I'm putting it all out there, and this is the way it is. And it's something that I greatly appreciate. But you talk about growing up, always kind of crossing borders, inside-outside perspective. And I wish you would just read that from the bottom of page 10.
As I grew up, my four parents' group efforts made feasible the transitions between the mostly white, middle-class, private school day-to-day and the mostly poor, black and Latin, prison system that was a constant thread in my life. I lived in two parallel worlds. My family taught me radical politics from day one, but I also learned to prove myself through elite institutions. Brought up with the privileges and opportunities the United States offers some, and a political line that condemned the very existence of an elite, I lived a contradiction. Life's incongruities were not merely between theory and practice. Much of the left-wing politics took root, despite the exclusive networks and institutions, because prisons are a great equalizer.
So be honest, was there a part of you that was like, I'm going to go live my own Che Guevara experience, this is what he did, and I see myself through his eyes? Was that at all a part of it?
Well, you know, certainly there's that appeal. But, you know, I was 18. I was hoping just to get out and see a little bit of the world and have a bit of an adventure. And it turned into a real love affair with the region, with the language, with the food, and with traveling itself, and with the experience of being out on my own and trying to make sense of totally new places and people on a daily basis.
What do you find yourself remembering? What are those core memories and lessons that you find yourself going back to that you look at, in a sense, to ground you while you're living your life now in the United States?
One of the things that certainly stands out is a lesson I learned very early on, which is that there's a big difference between people and their government. And that lesson was one that I remember reflecting on then, and it stays with me today. You know, another one, I think, is just the generosity and a willingness to be open to the world and to foreigners in particular. And, you know, the warmth and generosity that people all over Latin America showed me when I just showed up with a backpack and, you know, total stranger, they had no reason to trust me or let me in. I really wish we could do a better job of that in this country with particularly immigrants from Latin America today. In fact, one of the things I'm spending my energy on in law school is a worker and immigrant rights advocacy clinic in which I get to represent immigrants and immigrant workers. So it's definitely something that I've drawn on my experience in Latin America, knowing the countries and the backgrounds that many of my clients come from is something that helps me tremendously in the work that I do now as a law student.
Well, we love that, Chesa. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Chesa Boudin's new book is Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. According to her website, her full name is Maria Rosario Pilar Martinez Molina Baeza Rasten. But you know her by one name and one name only, Charo.
I brought the Gucci. Yeah.
That's right, the Gucci girl. Born in Spain, raised in Morocco after her father fled the Franco regime, wed to bandleader Xavier Cugat in a marriage of convenience so that she could move to the U.S. and perform with his band, married for real this time to producer Jel Rasten, a mother and international star for decades, Charo has had a career and a life that most of us can only dream of. And she did it with an acumen for both the show and the business of show business that belies her Spanish sex kitten image. And I'm very pleased that Charo joins me now on Latino USA from her home in Beverly Hills. Welcome to the program, Charo.
Thank you very much. It's great that you invite me because I don't know, you know, a little bit about me, but I am celebrating now daily the huge success that Latinos are having in this country. I was the pioneer. I was the guinea pig, the one that I fight day and night against producer, against director, to introduce what I believe that it was passion, energy, fun, and that's how I describe our music and our food and our culture. We are in, Maria. Viva la revolución.
pero, because, you know, when I was thinking about this interview, of course, you have to imagine, Charo, that I'm the daughter of a Mexican medical doctor who was devoting his career to helping to cure deafness at the University of Chicago. And my dad speaks with a very thick accent. So when I would see you on television as a kid, something would go on inside me where I'd be like, well, wait a second. I really love her, but why is it also that it's almost like she's a parody? And that I would be like, I mean, I laugh at my dad. We laugh at my dad. But I don't know if I want the whole country laughing at my dad because he has an accent.
Well, Maria, in my case, when I came to America, I didn't know one word, but I learned fast that if I can use my problems into my benefit and I make people laugh, I was the one that I was laughing all the way to the bank. So, Maria.
Does it bother you, though, when people have said that you have caricaturized Latinos and women to a point where it's entirely funny, but there is a part of people who just say, but why such a caricature? What is it when people
raise that
to you?
When I was very little, I discovered that it's a bless of God to make people laugh. I used to copy a dog that my grandmother adopted from the street that he was dying. He was hurt by a car, and she called him Cuchillo, which is mean knife, which is mean that if the dog bites you, you are in a big trouble. So the dog wiggled too much. It was not a normal dog. Probably after the accident, he shaked so much because probably he broke something in his spine. So I copy the dog and I shake him. I was 3 years old and I shake like him. Then I go to my grandma, whatever. I say, mira, mira, como cuchi, like cuchi, because I could not say cuchillo. I was shaking too, and they were laughing. And I swear to you, Maria, that I said, what a business. If every time that I shake, these people hug me and give me money, I got no more problem. So I started in that business, making people laugh and dancing and shaking.
Okay, of course, there are people who are going to say, that's not true. There's no possible way that there's a dog called Cuchillo and that you would be Cuchico.
Absolutely. Listen, when a kid see that you are laughing for something, this kid is going to repeat that 24 hours, 7 days, because he's going to get the attention and he's going to have the fun and the admiration. Oh, what a funny kid. Every time that I was shaking and say, como Cuchi, como Cuchi, and they were giving me caramelos, candies, or hugging, or calling each other, Charo, Charo, do the same thing, me, Cuchi, Cuchi. So that's how I start my business.
You know what, Charo, I mean, part of what's amazing to be talking with you is, of course, not only the fact that I grew up watching you, but you were, at that time, I mean, you have not stopped being, but at that time, you were really part of Americana. You were an icon. I mean, you were on The Tonight Show. You were on The Carol Burnett Show. I mean, these were huge times. Do you, when you think back about those times, were you like, oh my God, I'm a huge star? Or were you still just like, soy esta niña y a ver qué puedo hacer? You know, I'm just this little girl and I'm just kind of figuring this out.
Oh, are you kidding me? Every time they called me, it was first a fight. Can I play my guitar? When they say no, then I said, if I do what you want, how much money are you going to give me? I swear to you, Maria. Well, we're going to pay you whatever it was, $5,000 a week, whatever it was, the salary that they pay to celebrity in those shows. Then yeah. I said, okay, well, let me multiply how much it is for pesetas. Ooh, yes, I can pay bill, I can do this, I'll be there. Cuchi, cuchi, cuchi. It never occurred to me that I came to America and I make it. What it was very important for me, when I'm going to be strong enough, when I'm going to have a voice, now that people learn my name and they open doors for me, that I can play my guitar, that I can show to United States and the world that I'm a serious musician, which because I was trained for 7 years by the greatest maestro guitarist, Andrés Segovia.
Actually, he was a very tough teacher, wasn't he?
He was a pain on the neck.
He had he was no really pain. Hard on you.
No, no. What happened is he feels sorry for me competing with these guys because there was no student girl in the foundation of the Mr. Segovia. And he saw my passion and he saw my dedication. Well, as a matter of fact, he selected me to play with him a duet in front of the king with the symphony, Romance of Love. He saw in me that I had to make it or break it. It was no other choice. I show up there earlier than no other student, very, very nervous, very scared, and trying to learn the most I could because I knew that if I graduate and I find job, I could save my family. It's a long story, Maria.
So your family was a very humble family?
No. My father was a politician against Franco.
Wow.
And when you are a politician against Franco, you are immediately on the list. They could not execute him because he did nothing wrong. But definitely he tried to stop his brilliant career as a professor and as a lawyer. So he had to escape to Maroc, Casablanca, Maroc.
When you were a little girl, growing up in these tumultuous times, when you thought of the United States of America,
What was it that it symbolized for you then? I mean, what were the images that you had of who you were going to be as a young woman?
But when I was in Spain, and I was very little, I can see through the window of a restaurant American television, and they were showing Doris Day dressed impeccable, and they were showing American woman in the impeccable kitchen, touching button, and all of a sudden you touch a button and fire was there. They would touch a button and they were watching in the washing machine. Don't forget, Maria, that we were taking the water from the river and washing the clothes in the side of the river. It's in the south of Spain, Murcia, agriculture area. So I was dreaming, what is going on? These women are in heaven. How they can look so good in the kitchen? What the hell is that lady with impeccable hair singing, que será, será? I got to go to America. I got to go there and push a button. And all of those things, by magic, get done. So, yes, my dream came true. I graduated with honor at the age 16. Xavier Cugat, great musician, born in Spain, Barcelona, growing up in Cuba, for the same reason like my father. The father of Xavier Cugat have hour to leave Spain.
Wow.
Year prior, maybe 60 or 70 years, it was, again, political misunderstanding.
So here, I'm having this image all of a sudden, Charo, of like, you know, mainstream America watching Charo and Javier Cugat, who are basically the son and daughter of revolutionaries from Spain.
Absolutely. Xavier Cugat, rest in peace, his father took everybody and emigrated in emergency to Cuba. My father had 24 hours to leave Murcia through Andalucía, Peñón de Gibraltar, and going to Casablanca, Maroc, and suffer like you don't imagine until Franco died, and then my father came back with honor. But by then he was done. His moral was broken. And then from there on, I keep on going, but it never occurred to me, oh, I came to America and I made it. Are you kidding me? All I wanted is make money, pay bills, and wait for the opportunity so I can help other people as I'm doing it right now, teach young children, play guitar as I'm doing it right now, and establish this beautiful instrument, guitar, as the most important part of my life.
My guest today is Charo. More of our conversation coming up in a minute. No se vayan. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We're visiting with the incomparable singer, guitarist, and quintessential performer, Charo. So interestingly, you talk a lot about your career, about what it means to you to be able to make money, to pay your bills, to support your family, but to have a career. But at the same time, at the height of your career, when you were headlining Las Vegas, when you were as much in demand as Dean Martin or Ray Charles, you decided actually to pull back and you decided to devote yourself to raising your child.
Yes.
So, and that was okay for you? That was easy? That was difficult? That was a risk?
Well, that was the bigger dilemma. No more. Well, I was having a dilemma for at least 30 days. I was, as a matter of fact, opposite to Ray Charles. He was working at the Caesar Palace. I was working at the Sahara. I was making more business than anybody. I was breaking record. So I was thinking, what am I going to do? My child was approaching to the age 5. But he turned 5 on March 31st. And then I want to make a party for my son. And I realized that I did not have any single kids to be in the party. Guess who came to the party? Celebrities. Siegfried and Roy, all of the name, Joy Bishop, Jerry Lewis, whoever was working in town.
I can't believe it. These are the friends coming to your kid's birthday party.
To my kid, 5-year-old. And my kid was happy because he grew up with growing up people. But I look at him, you know, and happy, 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 woo, with a little whistle and a lot of gifts. And when everybody disappear and we all go back and do our shows, after the shot, I took a shower, I went to his bedroom, and he was sleeping, and he was surrounded by the little toys that we give them that day. And I made my mind right there, Maria. I said, this is the last time that I will work until my son graduate, grow up like a kid, don't travel anymore, don't depend on nannies, and have a regular children life. I say, I turn around to my husband and say, okay, let's have a glass of champagne. Tomorrow, I finish this job, but you cancel everything.
And wow, are you kidding? You canceled everything?
Over $2 million at that time, done. But I was working for the Hilton also, the company Hilton. And they say, okay, we're going to make a deal for you. If you desire to go to Hawaii, don't travel, and take care of, because we have business in Hawaii, and put your son in the best school in the United States called Punahou, which is the school where Obama graduated. So that was the whole deal. My son went to Punahou since the age 5 and a half, and I give up everything. Hilton Hawaiian Village, which is part of the chain of the Hilton, make for me a beautiful showroom called the Tropics. I name it the room, and I perform at night, and during the whole day, I was the mother, and the tutor, and the companion, and the whole family moved there. And I get out of there the day that my son graduate. That's all.
Wow.
I didn't pay no attention to nothing, no phone call. I passed Broadway to do the Life of Carmen Miranda. I passed so many things, you got no idea. But I make my mind, my son is going to be a kid, regular, don't belong in your business, and he's not going to write a book called Gucci Gucci Dearest.
So amazing story, Charo. I want to ask you, though, before we leave, about the fact that you never did give up, and you made your promise to come back and perform, and in 1994, with your CD, Guitar Passion,
yep,
you played on that CD a song called La Segadora y el Carretero, the Harvester and the Wagoneer.
That's for my grandma.
Tell me about that song.
Well, it means so much to me. My grandmother, you know what, Maria? If my grandmother will know how to write and read, she will be president of Spain if she born now. She used her common sense, and she was a very open mind. She never agreed why women had to be in the kitchen getting pregnant at night and cooking during the day, and she wanted that we have education. She was like a segadora. Segadora is the lady that go and do the harvest and cut the trigo y la cebada, the hay. And I dedicated it to my grandma. The music is completely my grandmother. She's my mentor. She passed away, but she's with me 24 hours. A strong woman, completely, completely unspoiled and dedicated to make happy to the people around. You know, it's so nice. When I wake up in the morning, I am Catholic, but no fanatic. But I respect God, definitely, to the maximum. All I pray, Maria, I swear to you, is no mistake. Don't hurt people. Don't make enemies. Don't give trouble to people. Try to go through the day the best you could. And if you can put a smile to somebody, you make the day. And that's my philosophy. Mm-hmm. And if I cannot, I find somebody that is not, I cannot make happy, then I pick up the phone and I say, hey, I got to tell you a joke. And then I start calling friends and telling a stupid joke. You want me to tell you a joke right now? Okay, Maria.
Sure.
This is a guy that robbed a bank. And coming out of the bank with a lot of money, he saw a witness. And he approached the witness and said, did you saw me robbery the bank? And the witness say yes. So the guy picked the gun and killed him. Then he go to the next guy and said, sir, did you saw me robbery the bank? And the guy said, I don't, but my wife did.
Qué mala.
Well, now that I made you laugh, I'm going to let you go because we, again, are so damn cute that we can do anything we want and nobody get offended.
Me encanta. Y muchos abracitos y gracias por tanto tiempo, Charo.
Muchas gracias. Gracias a ti. Okay, bye.
Chao, besitos. Bye.
Bye, bye. Bye.
Sure to visit our website at latinousa.org for photos you won't want to miss.
And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Walter Morgan, Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. Our listener comment line is 800-445-4005. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. And you can visit us online anytime at latinousa.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. By Lumber Liquidators, hardwood flooring for professionals and do-it-yourselfers. Catalogs at 1-800-HARDWOOD or lumberliquidators.com. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.